I'm Sonny Blechinger, KBOO's Artist in Residence for 2015. I hope you'll tune in on October 29th at 10 p.m. for my radio play, The Pool. It's about four people that happen to swim at the same public pool every week. And even though they don't know each other, they've mostly decided they don't like each other. And you get to hear their thoughts.
I don't know what I was thinking. Swimmy, this is horrible.
So please tune in for the world premiere, really, of The Pool on October 29th at 10 p.m. It'll be fun, like swimming.
People love swimming in the Crystal Plunge.
God, that creepy lifeguard is still staring at me.
Okay, let's just put the stuff down.
This is my time. My time in the pool.
Andy Warhol looks at screen. Hang him on the wall. Andy Warhol's silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Blake Schell. Blake is the iCults director and curator of the art gym at Merrillhurst University, and she's here to talk about Carts Uchi, an opera for one, which runs now through December the 5th at Merrillhurst. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO, Blake.
Thanks for having me.
Carts Uchi. Who is she?
Carts Uchi, she was an artist and professor at the University of Oregon in Eugene and also at the White Stag campus. And she passed away just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. So at age 51.
52, yes. So very young. Mm-hmm. And really it's a tragedy for the arts community. And she was really loved as an educator and known as a wonderful artist in this region. So we put together a retrospective of her work.
Mm-hmm. So the show itself is called Carts Uchi, an opera for one, but it's several pieces. And as you go into the art gym, on the left, on the big wall there, are a bunch of framed colored, they look like colored swatches, mm-hmm. and they have text on them. So what is that actual piece of work called?
So that piece is 20 Poems of Love and One Desperate Song. And that work is kind of a nice introduction leading you into the exhibition because it has a few different concepts that Carts often would work with. So one of those being translation. She often worked in translation between languages or between color and sound or between technology and something more emotional. And that work has lines from Pablo Neruda's 20 Poems of Love and One Desperate Song. And so, actually, I think I messed that up.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Rewind a bit.
Yeah. Can I start in the middle, kind mm-hmm. of?
Okay. Yeah.
So that work has lines from Pablo Neruda's 20 love poems and a song of despair. And Carts took lines from those poems and put them through Google Translate. So the lines come out somewhat recognizable for people who are very familiar with the poems, but a little off, a little strange, a little bit awkward, but also still poetic. And then in addition to doing the translation of the lines through Google Translate, she picked a color to go with each one, and that color was based on either some reference to color that Pablo Neruda had in that line or something emotional that she felt in thinking about that line or that poem.
Mm-hmm. So do you have can you read a couple of those odd lines? So the title of the book, the English title of the book of poems, which came out when he was like 20, right, is a Chilean poet who started pretty early, and he wrote 20 love poems and a song of despair. I guess that got changed into 20 poems of love and one desperate song.
Right. Yes, through Google Translate. Yep.
So what other English sort of translations are there?
So one here is, you have deep eyes where the night beats wings, fresh arms of flower and lap of rose.
And that's bright red.
Yes. Yeah, kind of a pinky red. And then one of the ones that I'll read out, this is my favorite one, between the lips and the voice, something is dyed. And so I think that it kind of has the concept of that something is lost in translation, but it's also talking about that something's lost in any type of communication, anything from you thinking or feeling it to expressing it, something gets changed. And so I feel like it really connects with an overall concept of her work as well.
What color was that?
This one's kind of a maroon color. Yeah, kind of a bricky maroon. Yeah.
Do you want to do one more?
Sure. Let's see.
Just do one at random. Because the way you experience this is they're in a row. Are they two rows?
Two rows,
and you
yes.
walk up and down.
Yes. And one of them, because there's 20 poems of love and then the desperate song, it's one row of 10 and then one row of 11, one at the very end. So this one says, I signal red on your absent eyes that they swell as the sea to the border of a light. And so that one is really a very kind of true red color relating to the line. And then this one says, while the sad wind gallops, killing butterflies, I love to you, and my joy bites your mouth of plum. And that color's kind of a plum purple.
Mm-hmm. So do you know how she assigned the colors? Is there some kind of theory behind it?
This was very intuitive. And so Cartes often kind of went back and forth between something that was more rule-based or conceptual and something that was more intuitive and how she felt about something. So if there was a reference of a color, then she connected with that, but also it was how she felt about the line or the poem.
And she's making these by computer, right? So she's not painting anything. She can just pull up a color, any color from Photoshop's millions. Is that right?
That's right. Cartes worked in digital medium. A lot of the output was different. So she had works that were neon and works that were prints and video and sound, different things. But part of how we were able to create this exhibition was that we got a hold of her hard drives.
Mm-hmm.
So we reprinted each of those prints because they weren't in existence as a full set like that. It was really an interesting process, and everybody who worked on it really kind of felt very connected to how she thought about things. But it also meant that we were able to be really accurate on the color because there were color profiles in there.
You've showed her before at Clark College in Vancouver, Washington. Did any of the physical material from those days make it over to this show?
The 20 Poems of Love, that is a different version of the project that she showed at the Archer Gallery. But the Archer Gallery, she did each of those lines in vinyl, in the color that she had assigned it.
Right. That's so, like a letter set kind of thing, letters stuck
yes,
on a wall.
Yes, that's
no
right.
No frame or anything.
That's right, yes. But because of that, because she did work in vinyl and things like that, that work didn't exist anymore. But she often worked in a lot of different iterations of the same work. So the fact that something would exist as a vinyl piece that was temporary but also exist as prints or have very different mediums even shown together, that was a common thing in her practice.
And was this just an option? You can print these if you want and frame them in with a block of color and a bit of text?
Yeah, she had printed them in a book before,
too.
Yeah, yeah, and that was at the Archer Gallery. So we went off of her size and scale and everything, and I think that she had them printed in one exhibition before as prints framed. In looking at how we wanted to organize the show, we were kind of deciding when we wanted to show multiple versions of a project and when we wanted to kind of hone in on one. And we worked closely with her colleagues at the University of Oregon, especially Tanaz Farsi, really helped us make those decisions. So we ended up deciding to show those as prints.
Did she leave a will? Kind of artist will?
There's some sort of estate that her nieces and nephews controlled, but a lot of the works didn't exist still, so we went about making them.
But was there any instructions? I mean, I guess how sort of in what kind of orderly manner did she leave Earth? Did she leave a bunch of instructions for how to deal with digital art?
No, not at all. We really could not have done it without Tanaz and without the U of O folks, and then also the hard work of Kathleen Murney, the new gallery manager. She's been the head preparator at the gallery for the last year, and now she's gallery manager and head preparator. And she really dove into all of the files and all of the different versions that were in Kartz's hard drive, and then made sure that everybody was aware of all the different things that existed or what parts we had, and then we had to make each of those decisions mm-hmm. about which one to do.
What would you say to an artist who's dying and has a bunch of unexecuted digital work? Would you recommend they make a list of instructions?
Well, it's interesting. Actually, what I would say is Kartz was very unique as she was sick and having trouble with her memory and all of that. She really didn't recede into a private space. She went out. She was very much a part of the community and was still making work. I think that openness and the fact that she continued to make work was much more important than the fact that she would do something so structured for what to come after. Instead, I think it really was an amazing experience just to know her in that stage. And I think that everybody misses Kartz so much. People were just really excited to help figure out what to do. And now we have this great record of her work from this exhibition and the catalog in particular. It's a really sizable catalog. And that's the kind of thing that the Art Gym has been doing, should be doing, will continue to do, is to be the record for the artist mm-hmm. and for this region.
Another piece is a darkened room that you go in, and the piece is called An Opera for One, and it's an hour and a half video and sound installation. What is that, and how does it relate to what we saw on the wall outside?
An Opera for One is a key piece for Kartz's practice and a really beautiful piece. So it's kind of the central work in the show. An Opera for One is also connected to Pablo Neruda's poems. And Kartz continued to explore the concept of synesthesia, connecting color to something like sound or an emotional state, and the fact that you would be able to translate something into color. And so for that, she hired a mezzo-soprano opera singer to sing the poems. And that's what you're listening to when you're watching An Opera for One, is that opera singer. And what you're looking at is a projection and a single bench in front of a projection within the video, where the color is changing on the projection in that room that you're looking into. And she selected the color based on her emotional connection with the singer and with listening to that opera. So it's changing out in colors regularly as you're watching it, based on how she felt about the text and the voice and the sound.
Mm-hmm. So you're watching a video of a bench and a little screen, and the screen just changes color. It's just a solid block of color.
Yes.
So it's like an orange, and then it's blue. Right.
Yes,
and there's
that's
no
right.
bench to sit on, so bring your own cushion. Right?
We thought about having a bench. I don't think there would be anything wrong with having a bench in it. Well, there are two things about the bench and the way that Kartz presented it. First of all, I think she wanted to make you aware that you were looking at a projection of a projection of a projection, and that was common throughout her work, where she really removed you from the original source. But also, I picture it as, it's called An Opera for One, and when you have that bench in the space, you really imagine a solo person, one person sitting there watching the color change in and out. So even if you're experiencing An Opera for One as a group, you can really imagine it as one person.
Mm-hmm. This is a Pablo Neruda poem translated from the Spanish. It's number 10 in the book, 20 Love Poems. It's called We Have Lost Even. We have lost even this twilight. No one saw us this evening hand in hand while the blue night dropped on the world. I have seen from my window the fiesta of sunset in the distant mountaintops. Sometimes a piece of sun burned like a coin between my hands. I remembered you with my soul clenched in that sadness of mine that you know. Where were you then? Who else was there? Saying what? Why will the whole of love come on me suddenly when I am sad and feel you are away? The book fell that is always turned to at twilight, and my cape rolled like a hurt dog at my feet. Always, always you recede through the evenings, towards where the twilight goes, erasing statues. So that's kind of one of the sad ones, but it comes under love. What do you think she does to the poems? Why does she have this kind of right to take the poetry and transform it? And what do you think she changes it into?
Well, I think it's really about that translation into color. And I think that that was something that came up again and again for her, where she was really interested in synesthesia. Somebody asked me if she actually would see color when she heard sound. And I don't know that that's why she started her investigation into that. But I think that she loved the poems and was really engaged with them. And they are so emotional and charged that I think they really are a great thing for really fluctuating emotional responses. And so it was ripe for her to explore what she felt with each line and with the singer's voice and the translation into color. Mm-hmm. But I think it was really about expressing another layer or looking at a different way of expressing those same kinds of emotions and feelings through color.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Blake Shell, and she's here to talk about Carte's Uchi, an opera for one, which runs now through December the 5th at Merrillhurst. There's another piece in the show called 368 Songs with the Word Sad in the title, mixed into one song. On one wall, it's silver lettering in a spiral. It's very big, and it goes down to the middle where it's overlaid so you can't read it anymore. And on the opposite wall is a turntable, beautiful white turntable with a clear vinyl record playing on it. What has she done there?
Those are two versions of that same piece that was so common with her. But we decided to show both of those versions because...
Oh, they're two different things.
Mm-hmm, they're okay. Two different pieces, but same concept. And I think that they work really well being shown together, and she'd shown them together before in a gallery years ago. And the wall piece is the titles of the 368 songs with the word sad in the title. Like you said, as you get towards the center, they're increasingly overlapped. You can read them on the outer edge, and as they get towards the center, it's jumbled. And then the sound piece is actually layers of all of those songs together in one file. It kind of does the reverse in that when it starts out, it's just noise, because layering 368 songs will really just make noise at first. But then as it gets towards the end, you start to hear individual lines from these different songs because different ones have ended already. And so you start to hear bits and pieces of it. Both of them are beautiful. They're very different. But I love that she was able to translate that notion of compression, and that sometimes you can hear or read something. She was able to translate it between something very visual and something that was very much just about the sound as well.
Mm-hmm. The way you could do it today is just type sad into Spotify and
That's
see
right.
what comes up. Do you think she did that?
She might have. She was working with Google Translate, like we said before. That would not surprise me if that's how she found them. Yeah. And then she worked on making that clear record player and the clear record and the attention to detail on the beauty of that. And when it's off, you can see the name of the piece within it.
On the turntable itself.
Yes.
It's sort of engraved in metal.
That's right.
there's a piece outside, so you can see it out the window. It's on the grass at Merrillhurst, and it's a neon sign, and it just says, "Further than everything."
We turn it on at dusk, and it stays on as long as the buildings are open at Merrillhurst. It'll have increasingly long viewing hours as it gets darker earlier. And that piece is on loan from the University of Oregon. We were really excited to have that work. We made another neon piece that was a different version that she'd never realized, titled Loser. And it's kind of the scripty, where you can sort of read it as loser if you know, mm-hmm. but if you don't know, it just kind of looks like strings curling out. And that piece is a double neon piece that has a blackout coating over most of it, where it's just a little blue tip at the beginning and the end of the mm-hmm. word. And that piece is inside the gallery, and you can see it, and you can also see out to Further Than Everything out mm-hmm. on the lawn, which was fun to get to lay out the show in that way and think about the outside as a possibility and extension of the exhibition. And we're going to have an event out on the lawn for the closing. People get to view the piece at night.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Further Than Everything meant to her?
Further Than Everything is a play on the words farther and further. Farther is physical distance, and further is metaphorical distance. In this piece, it's a reference to thinking about desire, pursuit of happiness. It was when she had relocated here, thinking about Ken Casey's cross-country journey on his magic bus Further. That was an unintentional misspelling of Further for the bus. It was spelled F-U-R-T-H-U-R. She really found that interesting and was connecting with language, what those different words mean, and her own idea of being in a new place, having traveled, what she was looking for in more of a larger sense or quest for her life as well.
Mm-hmm. And putting it on the grass at Merrillhurst, what do you think that does to it?
Well, it's interesting because it was shown both inside and outside in buildings at the University of Oregon. As we were looking for a place to put the piece, we had a few different ways where we might put it on the outside of the building or different places, but I think that having it out in the distance connects with that concept of the piece being about distance, and it also makes it viewable from the exhibition space, so it really ties in well, and everybody is able to see it who comes into the gallery. It ended up working out well for the concept of the piece and just the overall exhibition layout, too.
Mm-hmm. And the loser piece is really very small. It's like a foot long, right? It's 2 foot long. Like you said, it's a black squiggle.
Yes.
And it's all blacked out except for the beginning and the end of the L and the R.
Yes.
Any idea who the loser is in this?
I don't know. We don't have a real description of loser. I don't know what the source of that was for her, but she had created it in kind of a similar scripty or squiggle line in a few different variations, but this was the one that she had come up with that she had not done yet, with a double line of it. One of the things that happens when people come into the exhibition, they talk about the sadness that resonates throughout the exhibition, and that there's bittersweet moments, but also I think there's funny moments too, and loser I find funny because it's this representation of the word that's not a very good representation of the word. You can't really read it if you don't know what it is, so maybe it's just a loser of representing loser. I don't know.
She'd actually executed the work in neon other times?
Yes, but just in a single thread of neon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those pieces didn't exist still.
But this time it was instructions to do it?
Yeah, we worked off of her plans and her proposals and things that were in the files in her computer, and Kathleen Murney, the gallery manager, recreated a depiction of it into an Illustrator file or something like mm-hmm. that we could work with a neon company to have it made.
Is that what you do? You just send them an Illustrator file and they'll just Do they make it by hand, or is it a machine that makes the neon there?
Oh, I don't know the process. That's such a good question. I just know that we weren't able to get someone around here to do it. We had to go up to Seattle for the right color of neon and the double barrel or double strand or whatever it's called of neon with that blackout coating on there.
There's a video which shows an old-style wheelchair with the kind of brown vinyl and the no motor being dragged along behind some vehicle pretty fast. It's kind of thrashing around left and right. Did she know someone in a wheelchair?
Yeah, that piece is really, in a broader sense, about this town that her family lived in, a retirement community, how people were treated within that. So the videos are from earlier on in her practice that are all on the monitor there. They were definitely personal, but not so personal that it was about, that wasn't about a particular person. That was about the area and what she saw happening mm-hmm. with people not being taken care of in ways.
What area is this?
That piece was in Elliott Lake, Ontario.
There's a talk coming up. The 30th yes. of October, that's this Friday, day before Halloween. Who's Abby Donovan and what will the viewer get if they come to the talk?
There are several of us speaking together on a panel, and Abby is one of the writers. She worked with Kartz on her last piece that was created at High Desert Test Sites. And then Tanaz Farsi really helped us create the exhibition, and she's a friend and colleague of Kartz's. And then Prudence Roberts worked with Kartz on the original viewing of An Opera for One in Portland that was at PCC Rock Creek. She also wrote for the catalog. And so we're going to talk about knowing Kartz at different points mm-hmm. through her practice.
And this is 12:30 p.m., so lunchtime.
Lunchtime
this Friday.
Talk. Yes. Come out to the art gym. Yeah.
What? Will you be like walking around the room looking at things?
Or we might walk around. Discussion? It's more of a discussion about the process of creating the exhibition and then also kind of what different people saw in her work at different points. But we might walk around and look at particular pieces. Yeah.
Is this kind of exhibition closure to you, or do you hope it opens people up to her work? Because I didn't
what
know
a great,
her work.
What a great question. I think both. I think that you don't always get the opportunity to do something that is showing really beautiful, amazing artwork and also doing something that's good for a community. And I think that people really loved Kartz, and I think that it's been really powerful to see how people react, particularly people from Eugene, but a lot of people who knew her in Portland and Eugene really miss her, and I think that in some ways this exhibition has kind of been something of, I don't know if it's closure, but it's something that's like bonding for people where they're getting to talk about their memories of her. But also, I really hope to have this exhibition be something that makes more and more people aware of her practice. And the fact that we have the catalog as a record as well, I think is really great, because I'd love for more people to know about her work.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Blake Schell. She's the iCults director and curator of the Art Gym at Merrillhurst University. And she was talking about Kartz Uchi, An Opera for One, which runs through December the 5th. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO, Blake.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on the wall. Andy Warhol's on the screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, a regional gathering of community-based media makers sharing space and skills to build solidarity on November 14th and 15th on the Portland State University campus. There will be skill shares, issue-based strategy sessions, regional breakouts and workshops, as well as movie screenings and a keynote presentation, editors of Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, November 14th and 15th, on the Portland State University campus in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dia de los Muertos Celebration and Audio Cinema in Portland. On November 1st, from 1 p.m. to midnight, this is a celebration of life, honoring loved ones that have passed on via food, live musical performance, live dance performance, sugar skull decorating, children's storytelling, and much more. Again, that's Dia de los Muertos Celebration at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland, on November 1st from 1 p.m. to midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge, secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons. It bankrupts schools and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KBOO News Director